Chapter 10, From Your Plan to God's Plan. An underground revolution is sweeping the hearts and minds of the people of the world, and it's happening despite the wars and terror that confront us. This revolution is a fundamental change of worldview, and it carries with it the potential to reorganize the structure of human civilization. It brings a basic shift in the thoughts that dominate the world. It wages a peace that will end all war. It is a global phenomenon that will change the cellular structure of the human race. To those who are part of it, who feel called to it, its reality is a growing, if not obvious, truth. To still others, it's a lofty but ridiculous notion, a preposterous and silly idea. Yet no social revolution of any import emerged because everybody woke up one day saying, "I get it, I get it." Such revolutions emerge instead from what anthropologist Margaret Mead described as a small group of concerned citizens. Such groups are not only capable of changing the world, according to Mead, they're the only thing that ever has, and they're doing it now. A spiritually attuned counterculture is already in our midst. It is marked not by clothes or music, drugs or sex, as was the counterculture of the 1960s, but by the internal attitudes of those who perceive it. They make suggestions and comments that are just a little bit wiser. They bring new insights into areas previously locked down by the status quo. They see some star in the sky that not everyone is seeing, and in their presence, we start to see it too. We sign up for duty, for participation in this revolution, through a sincere desire to be used by something larger than ourselves for the purpose of healing the world. It doesn't even matter if we don't call that something larger by the name of God. As the Course says, some people conspire with God who do not yet believe in Him. It is ultimately not our belief, but our experience that matters. God has no ego by which to be insulted if we don't get His name right. So by whatever name we call Him, we come to realize that we are the army and He is in charge. He cannot use us to change the world deeply until first we have been changed by Him. In order to surrender the world to Him, first we must surrender ourselves. The change begins with a shift in the lens through which we perceive the world. It grows within us to affect not only our own lives, but also the lives of those around us. It leads us to connect with others who are similarly undergoing a transformation of their ego structures from an old perspective to something new. And through our individual and collective efforts, divinely inspired, we will turn the world around in time. Just when we thought all hope was ended, hope will reappear. So for those of us who are cynical, for those of us who are just too tired now, for those of us who are weary of the way things always go, for those of us who used to care but are too busy now just trying to get by, there's a change afoot. It begins in the heart, and as it rises to the surface, it will change all things. Imagine that God has asked you if He could use your hands and feet to go where He would have you go and do what He would have you do. Imagine that God has asked you if He could use your mouth to say what He would have you say and to whom. Imagine these things because He has. Many are called, but few are chosen. That line means that everyone is called, but few care to listen. The call goes out to all of us all the time. None of us has more or less capacity for contributing to the salvation of the world. Choosing to serve God, we are choosing the path towards God's greatness within us. When we see people who are clearly letting the Spirit work through them, who have found their genius, their power, their passion, we're not seeing some special force at work that chose them over others. The power did not choose them so much as they chose it. Those among us who have achieved the most have achieved only a fraction of what all of us are capable of. The gifts of the Holy Spirit are waiting for all of us when they are dedicated to God's plan. Every morning we have a choice. Will I seek out God's plan today? Or will I go about my day a slave to my ego's agenda? To choose God's plan is to choose the option with the best opportunity for turning your life into a conduit for the miraculous. As soon as we start asking how we can help with His plan, rather than just asking Him to help with our plans, everything will be better for everyone. While there are hate-filled people planning ways to sow violence and destruction on Earth, God has a blueprint for creating peace on Earth. It's not a physical blueprint, but rather a plan that exists in His mind, pieces of it ready to be downloaded into the mind of anyone who asks to receive their part. Each of us carries maximal potential to be used by God to heal the world. He has a plan, and it cannot not work. Our Father's business. Sometimes, going about our Father's business involves something we don't do as much as something we do. It can be our passive resistance, even more than a direct challenge, that subverts an unjust influence. I knew a minister whose job was terminated unjustly, and the board of directors at his church chose to assassinate his character in order to avoid any challenge from his congregation. He was understandably upset, yet the actions of many friends who supported him truly touched his heart. One was a woman who cut his hair every month. After the minister's dismissal from the church, one of the board members, a man who had been largely responsible for the campaign against him, began going to her to have his hair cut as well. Every month he would come in, sit in her chair, and repeat the same mischaracterization of the facts, steeped in self-serving untruths and denial. After a couple of months, the woman simply didn't wish to cut the board member's hair anymore. She no longer felt good about doing business with him. Her loyalty to her friend and standing firm in a principle of righteousness as she understood it mattered more to her than business. She couldn't understand, she said, how a place could abuse people and still call itself a church. She called the board member to say she no longer wished to cut his hair. The woman's action was a demonstration of Mahatma Gandhi's principle of nonviolence, which declares that moral force emanates from righteous action. While such force might not have observable effects, it indeed has effects on an invisible plane. By simply standing in truth, not only in our words, but through our behavior as well, we help create a wave of power that will heal the world. We never know what effect our simply standing on truth might have. We think, I'm just one person, what difference can I make? But none of us is just one person. All minds are joined. And each of us, every day of our lives, has a chance to say yes to something that could make the world a better place, and no to something that degrades it. We're sometimes looking for the big plan that will save the world while not recognizing our own part in it. The plan that will save us involves little ways that each of us becomes more righteous every day. And enough tiny droplets in time make up an ocean. The woman who refused to cut the hair of someone she knew had wronged her friend did not just help her friend, she helped herself as well. By fueling the forces of loyalty and integrity, she generated moral power that added to her own spiritual stature. It's not enough to simply talk about goodness. The fact that I say, I love you, means little unless it's acted on. The fact that I say, I love you, means little if you do not experience me as a loyal and ethical friend. The fact that I say that I love you does not make everything all right if my behavior argues otherwise. That's often the problem with the so-called spiritual worldview. There are those who act as though the use of the L word renders an authentic effort at ethics, integrity, loyalty, or even honesty unnecessary. But surely God is less impressed by our words than by our deeds. Love isn't always easy. And if it doesn't stretch you personally, then it probably isn't love. The goal of God's will. For many of us, the problem is not that we don't believe in God or don't want to be conduits of His love. The problem is simply that we have quite a few other goals as well. We don't recognize how our separate individual goals can actually get in the way of God's. The miracle worker is asked to do two things. One, see forgiveness as our function, and two, relinquish all other goals we have invented for ourselves. Sometimes people ask me about my early years lecturing on A Course in Miracles and the interesting ride I've had professionally. 20 years have passed since I gave my first talk, and from this vantage point I can see clearly why my early accomplishments came rather effortlessly. I had very little, and I wanted little more. I was delighted with my apartment, my work, my friends, my life. I was so completely naive to concepts like bestseller status, royalty statements, lecture dates, house payments, public perception, or anything else in the material world, that I gave total energy to the work I felt moved to do. My naivete was an asset. Walking through a fancy store never used to cause me stress. I couldn't buy anything, and I knew it, so it was like walking through a museum. It's when you can buy one good dress, but no more. That's when the stress kicks in. Now, when I read that as a miracle worker, I'm supposed to relinquish any goals I have invented for myself, I'm definitely stopped short. Lecture dates, nest egg, enough for Emma, book contracts, and the list goes on. The world has both rewarded me and imprisoned me. Like many of us, I built a prison around myself and now have the audacity to complain. So we get caught in a loop. We're trying to escape the pain of a world which is the pain. The innocence of ignorance, when we were pure of heart because we simply didn't know anything else, surely must be beautiful to God. But perhaps there's another kind of innocence as well, an innocence lost and then regained, having been consciously chosen by one who does know something else. It's one thing not to covet because we wouldn't even know what there is to covet, and another thing not to covet because we've been there, done that, and it didn't fix us anyway. Think how useful we are to God then, when our own goals have been superseded by His. Often we try to get clear about what our goals are, figuring out a 5 or 10 year plan, making treasure maps, identifying those we wish to emulate. But we should think about our spiritual goals as well. The question should not just be, where do I want to be in 5 or 10 years? It should also be, who do I want to be in 5 or 10 years? How long until I move beyond judgment and blame? How long until I stop playing victim? How long until I forgive myself and make the most of the life I have? Our goal in any situation should be that God's will be done. We will be told exactly what we need to know in every instant that our hearts are open. God speaks to us through what is called the small, still voice for God. Through forgiveness, prayer, and meditation, we can quiet the mind enough to be able to hear it. Inner peace brings more positive experiences into our lives because it aligns us with superior aspects of our own personality. We shift from grandiosity to grandeur, from littleness to magnitude. We attract rather than repel affection and trust, and just as important, we develop the power to retain them. It does little good to attract our good if we're too frantic or uncentered to hold on to it once it gets here.